The frogs.
Bollocks.
Hello. Hi, and welcome to the third episode of the Frogs Bollocks podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in and for all your love about the previous two episodes. We're still finding our feet with things a little bit and figuring out how it's going to work. But so far, seems like you guys are enjoying it and we're having a lot of fun.
Yeah, it's been great. It's been so nice to see your comments and all your questions, by the way. Thank you so much for everyone who sent in to the email and to our social media. We really appreciate it and we can't wait to go through all of those things with you later.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it's a good opportunity, isn't it, for us to get conversational, us to get a bit silly, to try and bring some humour into the nature and climate conversation, which yeah. Sometimes is lacking.
Yeah, a podcast about nature and our wild lives.
Oh, God, James, that's so cringy.
Is that the byline for the podcast?
No.
Is that official?
No, that is the most...
Nature and our wild lives.
What? No, sorry, veto.
Damn. Worth a try.
That's so cheesy. Anyway, what's been going on this week?
I've had quite a busy week. I've been here, there and everywhere. But what's been quite nice is I've been down south and I've seen my first butterfly of the year. A beautiful brimstone.
Oh, that's nice.
It was really nice because we live high up in the Scottish Highlands. So spring arrives quite a bit later for us. So it's quite nice to be down south and to kind of get the kind of the spring vibes because it's still feeling pretty cold and we had snow yesterday.
So
it was quite nice to be down south and see the beautiful brimstones, and it just instantly made me feel happy. You know, it's quite a common butterfly and it's one of the earliest emergences of butterflies, and yeah, they're just so brightly beautifully colored, and it yeah really lifted my day.
Well, they do stand out, don't they, whenever they're flying around that gorgeous yellow color. You immediately are attracted to them, and I think there's something about the color yellow, it just makes you feel bright and
exactly like the daffodils. It's like the daffodils of the butterfly world.
Oh, that's really nice. But it's funny because even up here, you know, the chiff chaffs have started. And then we got snow.
Yeah.
But everything's thinking like, what the hell is going on?
I know, I feel so sorry for the birds because it's nothing new that the climate is a bit messy, let's say, it's safe to say. And here in the Highlands, we go through these massive fluctuations of extreme cold to then being plus 10 degrees. So we have these like hard frosts and deep thaws, and all the birds kind of think, oh, right, great, it's springtime. And then all of a sudden, bam, minus 3 in snow. And it's just, I just feel really sorry for them all because there's quite a few species that are nest building and singing and mating, and they've got to sort of rewind a little bit because we're back into winter.
It's hard, isn't it, and it's hard to see, but this is why we're still feeding the birds as much as we can to give them that boost. So we've still got our fat balls up. We probably won't keep them up all spring and summer, but just whilst the snow is still here and they're a little bit confused, you know, we'll keep feeding them as frequently as we can.
What you been up to?
Well, I've got a couple highlights actually from this week.
A couple?
Yeah, because there's some really exciting things that have been happening. I've been here, there and everywhere, as per usual, but I've spent quite a lot of time down in Edinburgh. And I was with two very good friends of mine, Ruth Tingay, absolute legend, and Ruth Peasy, who is a penguin fanatic, also absolute legend. And we spent time actually in the Scottish government because huge news, something to celebrate very recently, is that the Wildlife Management and Muir Burning Bill has officially passed, which changes legislation in Scotland to benefit wildlife for the better.
Yeah, this is big, big news. It's a big celebration for a lot of hard work from a lot of NGOs and organisations and individuals that collaboratively have worked together to get this over the line. And honestly, we can't thank you enough because it means such an amazing benefit for nature, like you said.
It's absolutely massive. So we all congregated outside Scottish Parliament for some photos and to talk to the press and stuff. And lots of organisations were there. So RSPB Scotland, Scottish Raptor Group were there. You had One Kind, lots of different people, Humane International Society. It was everyone that had come together, and obviously Ruth Tingay, who writes the Raptor Persecution blog. And it was wonderful because whilst we were stood there about to go in to watch this bill go through, we had peregrines above our head, and it was a beautiful sunshine day, and it just felt like a really good omen. And basically we went into the parliament and watched them debate a few amendments, but ultimately the bill went through without a hitch, and it means that snares are banned in Scotland. They are officially gone. Glue traps as well, gone. They're used normally to catch rodents. There are greater powers for the Scottish SPCA, which enable them to better tackle wildlife crime that they come across. It's a framework and licensing for grouse moors, which for me is like a massive, massive highlight.
Yeah.
Because we all know how damaging driven grouse shooting is, and how they manage that landscape. But there's also restrictions on that landscape management. So they can't muir burn as freely as they once were able to. So it's a huge, huge win for wildlife. And I've got so much admiration for the people who've spent decades actually campaigning for this, you know, change in the law.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. It's a yeah, great way to start the podcast with the big bit of good news, because it's quite daunting, I think, at the moment. There's a lot of bad news going around on climate and biodiversity loss, and it can all feel quite overwhelming. So to have these little wins every now and again just kind of reinstates why we're doing this, and ultimately we can make a difference together, collectively, as individuals or organizations. We mm-hmm. can make change.
Totally. Totally. And Scotland is definitely leading the way, but guess what?
What?
Now, England, all eyes are on you.
Yeah. Pressure is on.
Pressure is on. We're going to be campaigning hard for similar regulations and licensing implementation in England. So that's the next job. The work never stops.
No. There's a long way to go, but we're getting there little by little.
What the fact? Ribbit. So, James, have you warmed up yet?
No, I'm still frozen to the bone.
Now, if you cast your minds back to episode one, the loser of What the Fact had to do a forfeit. And unfortunately for James, by 78%.
No, not 78%.
Yes.
No, hold on. Let me just quickly go on to back on Twitter.
I won by 78% as voted for.
72.8% actually. You okay. need to drop off 5.2%.
Okay, but I mean 72.8% is still stinking the lead.
Yeah,
stinking
big margin.
The lead? Is that?
Well, it was a stinking situation, so yeah, go for it.
Okay, I was stinking. It's one thing I do with dyslexia, I just mix things up all the time. stinking the lead ahead. with 72.8%. Thank you very much to everyone who voted for me and my brilliant, brilliant fact. James had to take the plunge in the river.
Mm-hmm. And you were very humble. You know, you didn't gloat once. You didn't. No, she definitely did. She was very,
no,
very.
I'm a very supportive partner. I wouldn't dream of gloating or laughing or
cackling away like a wicked witch.
I didn't enjoy it at all.
No, it was very cold, and you know, you may have won the battle, but not the war, as they say.
But anyway, for anyone who missed it, the video is posted on our social media, but you can take a listen to James's reaction now.
Oh God. Do you know what? It wasn't too bad compared to when we went in on New Year's Day. We all went with our neighbours for a New Year's Day dunk in the river, and it was a lot colder then.
Yeah, that was painful.
I mean, to be fair, this was painful as well. This it's a sort of temperature where you get in and it almost burns your skin. It's that cold. It's kind of like needles in your skin. But, you know, it's invigorating. Makes you feel alive.
Right.
Although, it was the worst timing because it bloody snowed.
Yeah, it was frosty on the ground.
4 days to do the river swim. I chose the one day in the last, like, month that it snowed.
There you go, but you did it, and I'm proud of you, and, you know, you took it like a champ.
Thank you.
You took defeat like a champ.
I've got another one, a new forfeit.
Okay.
So we've both been trying to rack our brains to, like, think of forfeits, and we're struggling. I think people at home, you should let us know what you think our forfeit should be, because it'd be great to get your input. So write in at info@thefrogsbollocks, or let us know on social media. But my forfeit that I think we should do.
Mm-hmm.
Is to eat one of the world's hottest peppers.
Oh no.
The Scotch bonnet.
Oh, okay. Well, yeah, I mean, I could eat Scotch bonnet peppers for breakfast, lunch and dinner.
You definitely cannot.
I wouldn't even be fazed, but I wouldn't even break a sweat.
You break a sweat with sweet chili sauce. You're a wimp when it comes to...
I don't like sweet chili sauce, no. I don't really even like black pepper. So
yeah, we're both pretty bad. I mean, I'm a tiny bit better than you are, but... To give you a kind of sense of scale, the Scoville unit for a Scotch bonnet is 100,000, which might not mean anything, but a jalapeno, which most of us are familiar with, is only 2,500.
Well, why don't we just eat jalapenos then if we both don't like it?
Because it's just not enough. We need to spice things up, as it were.
Okay.
And we could go all the way. We could go to the Carolina Reaper, which is 1.5 million Scoville units.
No.
And our friend's dad grows them.
No.
So we have access to all of the world's hottest peppers. In fact, Big Al has got a jar of sauce made from all of the world's hottest peppers combined. So we could go for that if you wanted to.
Absolutely not.
You want to stick with Scotch Bonnet?
Yes.
Yeah, it's kind of Scottish, isn't it? Scotch?
Yeah, I know we need to throw ourselves in at the deep end, but for me, the Scotch Bonnet is like the Mariana Trench of the deep end.
Okay.
I don't need to go any further. Good.
Like you bring it back to wildlife. Good.
Well, you know.
Do you want to go first then with your fact?
Not really.
So the theme for this week was Survivor.
Okay, so my fact this week isn't so much about one headline. It's about an animal which I believe to be one of the best survivors on the planet. And it's probably not what you'd imagine it to be. So James, I'm going to get you to guess what animal I'm talking about here.
Okay.
So the French naturalist first described this species in 1749, and his name was Georges Buffon. Uh-huh. Now, he described this animal as the lowest form of existence, an imperfect sketch on nature, claiming that one more defect would have made their lives impossible.
Defect?
One more defect would have made their life impossible. Remember, this was, you know, in 1749, so they didn't really understand what might be a defect actually might be working for their advantage.
So I'm trying to think of animals that are defected.
Or seemingly defective. Defective. That's the key.
Oh, I'm really struggling to think. Like a tortoise?
The lowest form. You're along a right line.
Turtle?
No. But, well, you're thinking kind of right in terms of slowness.
Something that's slow. I don't know.
Sloth.
A sloth.
Mm-hmm. Mm. I love a sloth. I'm all for sloths any day of the year. They're just adorable.
Yeah.
But they do have this reputation about being really lazy and boring and sleepy. And what's the point of a sloth? Yeah, what do they do except just hang there all day?
One of the seven deadly sins is a sloth.
But
a sloth.
I'd argue entirely wrong, because this is an animal which has been built specifically for survival. And I'm going to tell you some of the characteristics that make it the ultimate survivor.
Excellent.
So as you may well know, sloths are a tree-dwelling tropical mammal that live in both Central and South America. And they're so good, they evolve twice separately. An example of convergent evolution, because they're just so successful at what they do. And they're designed perfectly in terms of their biology and ecology towards living in a very stable and predictable environment, which most rainforests are in those regions of the world. So there's two types. You've got the two-fingered and the three-fingered. But do you know what they're most related to? What's their kind of closest animal relation? 5 points if you get this right.
Closest relation to a sloth. Do you know what? I have absolutely no idea. I can't think of anything that looks like a sloth in that region that's going to behave in a similar way. I'm stumped.
No, but it is a really hard one, because sloths have been unchanged for a very, very long time. So Sure. Their closest relative is actually quite far away from them.
Okay.
Shall I tell you the answer?
Mm-hmm.
Anteater.
Anteater?
Mm-hmm.
Right, well, it kind of makes sense. I guess their feet look very similar.
Well, they've got the claws.
Yeah, long claws. I suppose if you kind of like flipped an anteater upside down and squished its face in, that kind of gets you a sloth. Didn't it?
If it didn't have such a long nose.
Yeah, well, they've got shaggy coats, don't they?
Very coarse coat.
Yeah.
Very coarse anteaters.
I bet they both stink as well.
I've sniffed both.
Uh-huh. And?
Yeah. No, they smell quite nice, actually. You know, I once had an anteater lick my armpit.
What?
Mm. I was filming for Animal Park at Longleat, and I was hand-feeding an anteater some mealworms, and after it finished the mealworms, it was looking for more. So it wrapped its tongue around my arm.
So I thought, oh, this smells a bit like a mealworm. Your armpit. Delicious.
Oh, yeah, that's not very complimentary, but no. It was a hot summer's day. And it was amazing being licked by an anteater. That's my claim to fame.
Disgusting.
Mm. Anyway, should we go back to sloths?
Yes.
Okay, so while sloths seem like this really slow-moving, dull animal, they've developed some ingenious strategies to help them make the most of their environment. So the first thing to say is that sloths can't maintain their own body heat, which for a mammal is quite unusual. So sloths have to bask in the sun a lot of the time to warm up, and they've got really, really slow metabolisms. So much so that it can take a sloth 28 days to digest one singular leaf.
Oh God, I would starve as a sloth.
No, but you wouldn't. So the majority of sloths actually have a full stomach most of the time.
Mm-hmm.
But they can still die of starvation on a full stomach.
Right.
This is because if they get too cold, if they can't maintain their body temperature by basking in the sun, they actually can't digest the food. So they don't actually eat very much very often. But if they're not warm enough, they can have a full stomach, but their body just won't be able to process it, which is really interesting.
So hold on, we're talking about the ultimate survivor, and you're saying if it's a bit too cold, then it struggles to eat.
But this is the whole point I'm getting to.
Okay.
Okay, there's reasons for everything.
Okay.
Reasons for everything. So a very wonderful scientist that I've spoken to on a number of occasions, Dr. Rebecca Cliff, started the Sloth Conservation Foundation. And she does lots of work with these magnificent animals. And she's discovered that sloths are able to increase their food intake on hotter days when they are better able to metabolize it. And this is a stark contrast to most other mammals, which tend to eat more on colder days to help maintain their body temperature. So sloths really do things backwards.
Right.
But they're also a lot stronger because of it. So despite the fact that they only have 30% of the muscle mass expected for their species size, they're still 3 times stronger than the average human when it comes to gripping strength.
Oh, right.
Mm-hmm.
3 times stronger.
3 times stronger than humans when it comes to gripping things. And they don't actually have that much muscle. So they might look dense and muscular, but a lot of that is actually their fur. And they have reduced muscular tissue to help them preserve energy. For sloths, it's all about maintaining as much energy as they possibly can.
Yeah.
Because they don't eat or digest things as often, you know, all the time. Or they don't know when they, you know, the conditions will be suitable enough that their metabolism will be high enough for them to digest their full stomach.
Sure.
So one of the other adaptations, which we've already touched on with the anteater, is that sloths have these remarkable claws. Now, they're curved and they're long and they grow continuously. And over time, they get filed down as the sloths move very slowly around their ecosystem. You know, so it's a bit like, you know, keratin, your fingernails. It's always continuously growing, but naturally gets worn down over time. But they use these claws to hang upside down within the tree canopy. They sleep hanging upside down. They eat hanging upside down. They can give birth while still suspended. Again, limiting their time, you know, on the floor of the forest. They never really go down to the floor except to defecate. So they'll nip down for a quick poo and go back up because, of course, the forest floor is filled with predators. So the more time they can spend up in the tree canopy, the better.
Okay, so why bother going down to defecate in the first place?
Well, because you don't want to cover yourself in poop. And
you
let me get
dangle.
To
if you've got the strength, you can just dangle. Free fall.
But they've got very coarse fur.
You could poop on the predator.
They've got... I think that might give their presence away.
Yeah, maybe.
So the reason why they want to go down to the forest floor to poo is because if they didn't, they would coat themselves in a smell. And sloths actually don't have their own odour.
Okay.
Right? So...
Not their own odour.
Not their own odour.
Right.
So sloths are the master of camouflage in so many different ways. More ways than we as humans can really understand. So there is a saying, actually, that if you shot a shotgun next to the ear of a sloth, it wouldn't move.
Okay.
I don't know where that saying came from, and I don't know who's tried it. I hope no one's tried it, because that's highly unethical. But apparently, if you make a really sudden noise, a really sharp, loud noise next to a sloth, its reaction isn't to flee and run very quickly like most mammals would. It's to stay as still as a statue.
Gotcha.
So it uses its slowness, its stillness, as the ultimate camouflage. They also do this because living within their fur is an entire ecosystem.
Yeah, I know. I've heard this.
But it amazes me every single time. So whilst they don't produce their own odour, their fur, which is very dense and consists of two various different layers, you've got the coarse layer on top and the layer for insulation closer to their body, which helps them with thermoregulation, they've got organisms living within their fur. So whilst they might be solitary by nature, actually, when you take a look at them, they've got this entire ecosystem of moths, beetles, parasites, arthropods, fungi, and algae living on their backs, some of which can be found nowhere else on Earth except on the back of a sloth.
It's pretty cool.
It's amazing. I mean, to have your whole body as basically an ecosystem is just mind-blowing.
And I'm guessing the moths are not parasitic in any way.
No, it's a symbiotic relationship. Yeah. So it's beneficial in both ways. And the reason why it's beneficial to a sloth is because it creates the smell of the rainforest. So any predator that happens to come across it, basically it's not only camouflaging itself by the way it moves, but it's camouflaging itself with scent because it smells exactly like the ecosystem around it. So it's making itself olfactory camouflagation.
Okay, we need a new word. We had avifauria, now we're gonna go for one that's mimicry through scent.
Yeah Inconsmellulous.
I like that. Inconsmellulous sounds like a Harry Potter spell.
Something like that. But I just think that for me, sloths are the ultimate example of survival. They've got entire ecosystems on their back. It takes them 28 days to digest a leaf. They're stronger, 3 times stronger than a human. They can hang upside down. Oh, I didn't mention this. Those claws are so strong that they can die and still be hanging upside down.
Wow,
on a branch.
That's pretty cool.
It's amazing. So if you think you have an animal, James, which is better suited for ultimate survival, I'm ready to hear it, because nothing can beat the survival of a sloth, surely.
Well, Megan McCubbin, my animal does indeed beat your sloth. It absolutely trounces the sloth when it comes to survivability.
Big talk, but let's hear it.
Well, you've gone for a kind of big animal, because I've gone for an absolutely tiny one. This is a David versus Goliath story. Yours is big, mine is only 0.5 millimetre to 2 millimetres long. There are 1,300 species of this animal, and I'm of course talking about a tardigrade.
Very good.
So these are tiny microorganisms that are also called a water bear, because under the microscope they kind of look like little six-legged bears.
Yeah, they're quite cute actually when you take a look at them. They've got like, I don't know, cute, well, not noses, but you just want to boop them.
Yeah, they're very boopable little small animals.
That would squash them.
You probably would squish them. But these microorganisms can be found all over the world. You can actually find them in your garden, hiding amongst the kind of mosses and wet kind of lichens as well. And they basically live there, eating algae, plant cells, other tiny invertebrates. But these animals are so well adapted that they can survive pretty much anything. Now, they've been tested under some of the most extreme conditions anything has ever been tested for. Are you ready to hear some of these experiments?
Oh, okay. I feel like this is going to say more about humans than it will about them.
Yeah, basically, I think that's what scientists have generally tried to do, is they've just tried to find what will kill a tardigrade.
A horrible thing to do.
It's a horrible thing to do, but it turns out not much will kill a tardigrade. So they've been placed into the vacuum of outer space and survived. They've been subject to extreme radiation and survived, although a combination of both of them together did actually kill them, but which is fair enough.
Yeah, because that's too much. Just over the edge.
Yeah,
just over the limit.
A bit too much. They've been frozen down to a temperature of 196 and survived for 30 years.
Oh, God, that is very cold.
That is a bit nippy. In fact, actually, it goes further than that, because some can even survive only for a few minutes, but at temperatures only 1 degree above absolute zero. So they can survive at -272 degrees Celsius.
That's just, like, incomprehensible. Like, you can't
imagine
what that would feel like.
No, I mean, these are under controlled conditions. I don't think anywhere on the planet gets down to -272 degrees.
No, it's not natural.
It's not a natural temperature, But nonetheless, these polar species can survive, even only for a few minutes, at minus 272 degrees. The highest temperature they've been known to survive is 151 degrees, which is pretty balmy.
That's an extreme difference, isn't it?
Yeah, that's a temperature shift of over 400 degrees.
I can't stand a temperature shift of like 10 degrees, yeah. 400.
We shrivel up like a prune.
We do.
Now, this isn't... So when they're frozen, it's not actually the longest time an animal has been frozen and revived. A tiny animal called a rotifer has been revived after spending 24,000 years frozen in permafrost. And apparently nematodes can survive for 30,000 years in permafrost. Mm. So it's not necessarily the longest surviving in cold conditions, but they've definitely gone down to the coldest conditions.
Yeah.
But other tests they've gone through is to do with pressure and atmospheric pressure. So the highest pressure a tardigrade has survived is 600 megapascals. Now, I need to put this into context because we don't really understand that very much, I guess.
No, I didn't really understand what that means.
No. So at the levels most of us live at, sort of at sea level,
yeah,
we are under 0.1 megapascals.
Oh, not very much at all.
Not very much. You don't really feel anything. So to put it into perspective, you know when you go in the water, in the swimming pool, and you drop your goggles and you swim down to try and get them and you feel that squeeze?
Yeah, when your ears pop.
Yeah. So for every 2 meters we go underwater, we add on 0.02 megapascals.
That's nothing really, is it?
It's absolutely nothing, but feels like a lot.
Wow.
So if you were to times that pressure that you feel when you drop your goggles and multiply that by 5,000, you then get to the pressure that tardigrades were under and survived.
We'd be crushed.
We'd be absolutely crushed.
We'd be thin as a piece of paper, probably.
So you know the Mariana Trench?
Yeah.
That goes down to 300 megapascals, so half that of the tardigrade's survivable pressure threshold.
So you'd have to go down to the bottom of the Mariana Trench and then double it.
And then double it. Mm. But at the bottom of the Mariana Trench, that's enough pressure to kill most multicellular life and bacteria on Earth. And yet the tardigrades are like, yeah, double it. Not a problem. I'll survive that. Easy.
Little tanks, aren't they, really?
All day long.
I love the accent that you gave
all
them.
Day long.
Is that what tardigrades
sound
like?
Yeah, they're all a bit cockney, yeah.
Because they're tough.
Yeah, exactly. They're tough, cockney little microorganisms.
Yeah, I like that.
So this is incredible. Cool. So how on earth do they do it? All these extreme conditions of being boiled, of being frozen, and of being crushed and vacuumed.
So it's one of those examples of just because we can experiment on these tough little things. Why?
Just pure frustration. Like, why won't you die?
It's horrible. Poor tardigrades. I really feel for them.
So the reason why they can survive all of this is through a process called cryptobiosis. So they slow their body to a near death-like state, which is called a ton. And essentially, they reduce their metabolism to only 0.1% of its original function. And their water content is replaced with these protective sugars, which basically protect all of the cell contents, just like jam jars.
Yeah.
You know, we pack jams full of sugar, which means they've got a very long shelf life. And this is what's happening with the tardigrades. So whilst water isn't available because they've been frozen or they've been boiled or dried or vacuumed or radiated, until that water's available again, their body is protected by all of this protective sugar.
Amazing, isn't it? So it's kind of like a biological antifreeze.
Exactly. So they protect themselves and they can withstand all these conditions because they've got this sort of antifreeze type product. Well, these protective sugars, which protects all of the cells. And what happens is as soon as water is available again at, you know, normal temperature, they kind of just rehydrate themselves and they're good to go again.
Off they go.
Off they go.
Wander off.
It's incredible.
Eat a few plant cells, hide in the moss, do tardigrade things. Go about tardigrade business.
Yeah. It's amazing for an animal that can only live maximum a couple of years. I mean, most species only live for a few months even. Under these conditions, they can basically increase their shelf life, just like jam jars, by this cryptobiosis.
It is a pretty good one. I'll give you that.
That's a pretty good one.
It's pretty good.
The ultimate survivor, well, under the category of survival.
I don't know whether... it's a very good survivor. But we'll leave it up to the audience to judge. But yeah. I do find it interesting that we've both gone for animals which slow themselves down in order to survive. Because there really is something to be said for kind of live fast, die young. But still, remarkable. But animals that slow down are kind of the ultimate survivors. And I think sloths do it pretty well. You think tardigrades do it very well. You guys at home get to decide.
Yeah, so we're going to be putting out another poll on our social medias. So make sure you go check us out on Twitter. I'm James E.G. Stevens.
And I'm at Megan McCubbin.
And yeah, we'll put the poll out straight away. So you're voting for the winner.
Yes.
That's the, you vote for who you think had the best fact. And whoever had the least amount of votes has to eat one of the world's hottest chilies.
Has to burn their taste buds off.
Mm, delicious.
Gross.
So as always, thank you so much to everyone who sent their questions and stories in. I've got a few questions lined up now. Megan, are you ready?
Yeah, go on.
So it's Josie333 on Instagram asks, how do anemones reproduce?
Okay, well, I'll talk about sea anemones. Mm-hmm. Because they are fascinating, bizarre species, and their reproduction strategy is very weird as well, but really interesting. So they can produce either asexually or sexually, depending on the species. And one sexual process is called broadcast spawning. And we see this with lots of different animals which are sessile and stuck to one place and don't move around. And essentially what they do is they release their sperm and eggs out into the water column in synchronized spawning events. It's quite dramatic when you see it happen because it's visible and they spurt all these gametes, sperm and egg, into the water. It's really cool. Ooh. Yeah, there you go. And once the eggs then become fertilized, not all of them do, of course, it's a bit of chance about sperm and egg bumping into each other. It's a bit more complicated than that, but you get what I mean. They develop into larvae and become zooplankton, part of, you know, plankton that we know all the time, zooplankton meaning microscopic animal, and they float around on the ocean currents. And they want to do that because you want really to settle as an adult anemone somewhere which is further away from your parent individuals so that you're kind of spreading the genetics around as far as you can. So once they've found a suitable spot, they then develop into a polyp and become something that we would recognise as a sea anemone today in a rock pool or wherever it may live. So another quite cool fact about them is that they are, some species are, sequential hermaphrodites, which means that whilst they are male and female and they are split, they can change their sex over the course of their lifetime. So if one produces eggs for a certain amount of years, it may then transform and become male and start producing sperm, which is mind-boggling bizarre, but really cool. And an example of asexual reproduction is something called binary fission. And there's really cool photos and videos of this online where you see these anemones literally splitting in half. And what they're doing is essentially cloning themselves. They don't get very far. You don't have that water current as a young larvae to move them around. But it's quite relatively easier thing to do in some cases. But the disadvantage of that is, of course, if there is a disease that were to come into that habitat and that population, you've all got the same genetics, so you're more likely to be wiped out. But there you go, different advantages for different species. And I think it's pretty cool.
Oh, it's fascinating. Now, this is the beautiful, you know, creatures already that have quite a funky way of reproducing. So yeah. they're overlooked often, but they're absolutely fascinating.
Very alien.
Yeah, totally alien. And a lot of them, you can shine under a UV light and they turn completely different colours.
Yeah, snake lock anemone. That's one of my favourites. It's kind of orange with pink tips.
Yeah.
Really cool.
Under UV light.
Oh, God, bright colours.
Bright greens and blues and purples. Amazing.
Yeah, really funky. I love the rock pool. One of my favourites. Okay, I've got another question for you, James. So Matt Davies asks, what happens to bees and ants during the winter?
So it's quite complicated because, like the anemones, different species have different responses. So for ants, they actually could potentially carry on acting and behaving in a similar way throughout the winter. So during the harsh winters in the nest, they might still be doing the normal things that they do inside the nest. They'll just be a lot slower and their activity will just be slowed down. Of course, they won't be out and about foraging as they would do in the summer. So they don't really hibernate necessarily. They can actually stay active within the nest. You just don't really see them. Whereas for bees, again, depending on the species, they have different responses. And bumblebees, for example, go through a process very similar to hibernation, but it's actually called diapause, where basically the queen bees that are the only ones remaining at the end of the summer, the queen bees will go off and find somewhere to hide away and be safe for the winter, and they drop their metabolic activity so that they're not consuming so much energy. So essentially they're hibernating to wait out the spring, and as soon as the spring finally arrives, they will kind of warm themselves up by vibrating their wings and kind of get their muscles warm, just like we do when we kind of shiver, and they'll go out and find the nearest source of nectar and pollen and get the energy back before finding a nest site where it can lay her eggs. And initially those eggs will hatch into female workers, which will also attend the nest, and then later on in the year she'll then lay eggs for males and for other queens. And then at end of the summer, only the queens are left, and the process happens all over again. So in the winter, basically, we don't see them because they're either hibernating or they're tucked away somewhere doing basically bugger all.
Well, if you were a small insect like they are, both kind of ants and bees, this is relevant to, you know, if you are that tiny and that vulnerable to the elements, you would just tuck yourself away and stay where it's safe and slow down as much as you could so that you're not wasting energy when you've got a busy spring and summer to get things done in.
Yeah, there's not much going for you in the winter. There's no flowers that are out that they can be using to collect pollen or nectar, so it makes sense just to drop all activity and just wait it out.
Yeah, exactly, why not? I can't blame them, really.
No.
Our special guest on this episode is one of our very good friends. He is an amazing botanist, a very talented author, and an excellent nature communicator who gets all of us to look at the detail and beauty of plants and appreciate their significance and importance. I'm, of course, talking about the one and only Leif Besweden.
Hello, my name's Leif Besweden. I am a writer and a botanist and a kind of like, I don't know, freelance botanical communicator. I don't really have an official job title, but basically I spend my entire life trying to convince as many people as possible that our wild plants are just the most incredible things and worthy of so much more of our time and attention than we generally give them. Okay, so you know how people are always like, our plants are boring? Well, they don't know about a plant called water soldier, which does something that I think most people just wouldn't think plants are capable of. So water soldier is an aquatic plant, and it lives in like ponds and lakes and things, and it floats at the surface of the water. Kind of looks like the spiky leaves of a pineapple sticking out of the water. Now, it's able to do that because its leaves are packed full of air pockets. So this whole thing is like pumped full of air, making it really buoyant, and so it floats on the surface. And it sits there through the summer. It photosynthesizes and, you know, makes its food and produces flowers and gets pollinated and, you know, produces offspring. And then in the autumn, when the days start getting shorter and it starts getting a bit chillier, it needs to kind of get out of there, because at some point that water is going to freeze over, which is going to completely mess it up and destroy its leaves and its sort of livelihood. So to avoid this problem, it sinks. So it breaks down those air pockets in the leaves. Those air pockets fill with water instead, and this whole thing gets really heavy and just sinks down to the bottom of the water. And it'll just kind of sit there. You know, the ice will form, winter will happen, and it's all like, you know, freezing cold and everything, and this plant will just nestle down into the mud at the bottom of the pond. But then the really cool thing is when the spring arrives and the ice melts, this plant will grow new leaves, inside of which it has these new air pockets. As it starts to photosynthesize, it produces oxygen as a byproduct. And instead of pumping that out into the air for us to breathe, it puts it all in these air pockets. And so the plant starts getting lighter and lighter and lighter, and more buoyant as it fills with air again. And it just floats all the way back up to the surface again. So you've got this plant which spends the summer at the surface, and then it's like, you know what? It's getting really cold, can't handle winter. I'm going to just, you know, not handle this at all. So it sinks to the bottom, hangs out there until it's all over. And then when it's all done, floats back up to the surface and just carries on as if nothing's happened. Absolutely amazing. So I was once looking for wildflowers in the middle of London in January. Don't ask me why. But I was in this really like grey concreted street and I found a plant called Shaggy Soldier just growing out the bottom of a lamppost in the middle of the pavement. So I crouched down to have a look. Now, Shaggy Soldier is, it kind of looks a bit like a daisy flower. And as the name implies, it's like really softly hairy. So I was just trying to work out how to give this plant like a little stroke without appearing completely insane to all the people who are walking past. When I heard this shout behind me, there was like a, hello, hello, what are you doing? And I turn around and there's this security guard behind like a fence a few meters away. And he's like, what are you doing? Like everyone inside is freaking out. You're on all the cameras and no one knows what you're doing. Can you please explain yourself? And I was like, oh, it's fine. I'm just looking at this Shaggy Soldier. Do you want to have a look? And he was like, wait, what? I was like, oh, it's Shaggy Soldier. It's this like wildflower. And it's just growing out of the pavement here, like straight out of the concrete. How mad is that? And he was like, what? What are you doing? And this went back and forward, back and forward. And I sort of realized that this guy just clearly did not believe that me, a guy in his mid-20s, was looking for wildflowers in the middle of London, in the middle of winter, just like on the pavement. That was obviously not true. And he ended up moving me on for disturbing the peace, which is something that I still haven't forgiven him for. One of the biggest threats to our wild plants here in the UK that doesn't get talked about as often as the obvious stuff like herbicides and things is deer. Now, that's probably quite controversial because I know lots of people think deer are very cute. And deer are, in the right numbers, very, very important for our plants here in the UK. But currently, we have an enormous number of deer that way outnumber the number that there sort of should be naturally if the predators that predate them were still here, like wolves and lynx and things. So the result of that is all these deer, which obviously eat plants, are doing untold amounts of damage all over the country to wild plants. And so if I were all powerful for a day and could do one thing to help them, I would sort of click my fingers and drastically reduce the number of deer roaming wild in the countryside.
Oh, I absolutely adore Leif. His passion for flowers is just infectious. I think if you had more people like him, we'd all be loving flowers.
I think we're just not taught about them at a young age as much as we are animals, which is such a shame considering they are literally producing the oxygen that we breathe.
Well, exactly. They're so characterful as well. There's like Leif described, there's some of these stories and behaviours of plants. It's absolutely phenomenal. But he does make a good point about the deer. We do have way too many deer in the UK, and it is controversial. It's very emotive because we love deer. I love deer. Yeah. You love deer. Everybody loves deer. They're incredible animals, and within the right numbers, they are massive ecosystem engineers. But the problem is now is that there are too many because we have no apex predators keeping them in check. So it means that big herds can go into an area of wildflowers, eat everything, and then move on. And obviously that has a knock-on effect for all of the different species that depend on flowers.
We used to have the predators.
We used to
saying that. I mean, go back a few hundred years, we had wolves and bears, and perhaps that's a subject that we will talk about later on in the podcast. But yeah, we used to have them. So deer numbers weren't always this high. But it is an issue that we need to be kind of looking at and talking about a lot more and getting a lot more comfortable with because of those absence of those predators, we're kind of having to fill that role.
Exactly. But Leif actually had a question for us.
Okay.
So you know how we go through life and we have these amazing interactions with wildlife and experiences of nature, the kind of moments that you feel like, I will just remember this for the rest of my life. It just makes me feel everything that I want to feel while I'm looking at nature. If you could share one of those moments with a politician or one of our lawmakers or decision makers, which one would it be?
Oh, I like that one. Okay, so for me, I would take the politicians out to get nose to nose with a badger. It's hard to get nose to nose with a badger because they've got a very good sense of smell. But when I was out photographing them, I spent a lot of time with a particular clan, and I would always remain at a distance away. But after a while, they ended up walking so close to me, and they were so distracted by the peanuts that were on the ground, they ended up bumping into my camera lens. But that was a really poignant moment, and I think badgers get such a bad rap, especially because in the news they're obviously going ahead with another badger cull. I'd like to take the politicians out and show them the good side of badgers and why we should be respecting them and listening to accurate science regards to that policy.
Yeah.
So I'd celebrate the badger.
Perfect. I think mine would be to show a politician a barn owl hunting at dusk. I remember the first time that I got a good glimpse of this. I was in Carlisle, a stone's throw away from the city centre, at this small nature reserve, and the light was going down. It was all golden and beautiful, and I could just see this ghost-like, beautiful figure flying over the meadow, and it took my breath away. And I went back day after day after day, and I stayed in the exact same position, and it would get closer and closer until eventually it was at the tip of my lens that I couldn't even get a photograph. But to be in this situation where you're so close to urbanization that you're having almost this kind of like harmonious connection with nature, we can live alongside it. And this was testament to that. This barn owl was totally, you know, oblivious to me. Well, it knew I was there, but it was totally
trusting
of my presence there. I wasn't being obtrusive, I wasn't being loud, I was just being respectful, and it would come close and I could just peacefully watch this beautiful animal doing its thing. And there was, you know, wildflower meadows, so which was a great habitat for obviously its prey items, and it just felt harmonious. And I think we often think of ourselves as being apart from nature, whereas actually we are a part of it. And that's so important, I think, for politicians to understand, is that we should be living as one, as cheesy as that might sound, but we should be encouraging wildlife to be in amongst us as well as encouraging ourselves to be in amongst nature.
Oh, it's such a good point and so, so valid. Thank you so much, Leif, for that brilliant question and getting us to think about that. If you are someone who's been inspired by Leif and his passion for plants, now is the time to sow your native wildflower seed mixes. You don't have to have a meadow by any means. A simple flower pot will do. Sow in your native wildflower seeds so we're able to support pollinators, wider biodiversity, but also just appreciate those firework blooms of colour that can emerge in the spring and summer in your garden. There's nothing better than some wildflowers. So that's it. It's now time to say goodbye. It's been a really great episode.
Yeah, thank you so much to everyone who's contributed. And please do send more of your questions and stories to info@thefrogsbollocks.com.
Yeah, it wouldn't be the same without you guys. So do send in your weird and wacky questions about nature. We'd love to hear them. But until next Friday, we'll see you soon. Have a great week.
Goodbye. You are the Frogs Bollocks.